welcome to the Celeria Report. Today is March 24th, 2016. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Upcoming events, April 30th at the 21 Club in New York City. We still have some tickets left, so it's going to be a great event. Last year was fantastic. Approximately 2 weeks from now, I'm guessing the second week of April, expect to start getting emails from us leading up to the launch of our new website. I'm really hoping this will go in April. It's been an extraordinary labor of love, and I think you're going to be pleased. Our theme tonight is whiteout, and we're watching a lot of things get whited out. The Brussels bombing and subsequent media about both the bombing and the war on terror is whiting out the true story about the push for centralized control, the competition among the factions who are pushing, and the slowdown in the global economy. Trump at this point is whiting out the Republicans for Clinton. I had thought when the campaign got going that Trump was going to be whiting out for Bush. Amazingly, the Bushes were not prepared for the dirty tricks. Can't fathom it, but it is what it is. And Trump at this point is whiting out the Republicans for Clinton. It all gives an eerie feeling, whether it's Brussels bombing, war on terror, or watching two candidates with enormously high disapproval ratings battling it out for the presidential election. Gives a very eerie feeling. And in the category of it just keeps getting weirder, it was announced that next month the Temple of Baal will, a replica of the 50-foot arch will be installed in Times Square in New York and Trafalgar Square in London. I mean, if anything proves that it was the Anglo-American Alliance who's had ISIS running around destroying temples, that's proof positive. To the victor goes the spoils. So let's look at money and markets. The U.S. dollar sort of recovered a little bit from the swan dive it took after the Fed announcement. It's now down 2.6% for the year. Bonds stayed relatively strong. The corporate aggregate bond is now up 2.36% for the year. Long Treasury ETF up 7.84%, and the junk bond high yield ETF up about 1.81%. So that market has recovered. S&P backed off a little bit this week, so it's now flat for the year. It's up about 0.14%. The DAX, the top German 30 stocks in euros, is down 8.3%. So Germany's struggling a little bit. China large caps down 7.23%. Developed markets outside of North America down 4%. And the emerging markets, the strongest equity market so far, 3.63% up. So that's backing off a little bit from the prior week. Gold and silver have been having a very strong year, but not a good week last week. Gold now up 14.66%. Silver got slammed hard this week, now up 9.4% for the year. Oil back down, now down almost 15% for the year, and the commodities index down 2.32%. There are multiple signs and signals everywhere of global slowdown, but nobody's had more of a slowdown than the planes that carry people to the European, to Europe from the United States. The State Department put out a warning, and I put a link up to it on the website, a travel warning on traveling to Europe, basically saying it wasn't safe. So one subscriber was headed for Switzerland this evening and said, wow, plane empty. So this is going to be very bad for tourism, to say the least. And it continues to be yet another assault on the European Union. We're getting multiple comments from various people. Dr. Farrell Saker, who I've interviewed, and that interview will be up in 2 weeks, saying they don't see how the European Union makes it. But remember, because you have so much now trading and depending on the euro, a breakup of the euro is very complicated. So whether it's the politicians who created the EU or the commitment and dependency on the euro, that's a lot of institutional clout to try and prevent it from coming apart. We see the U.S. and now Europe shutting Russia out of the capital markets. Russia was looking for a, investment bank to sell $3 billion worth of sovereign bonds. Russia has surprisingly little sovereign credit outstanding. It has a very low debt ratio. But we saw several weeks ago the American banks basically warned off by the State Department and the administration. They said no. Now we see many European banks have agreed, all afraid that they will be somehow violating the sanctions if they help Russia raise money. That means Russia's going to have to depend on the Russian and the Chinese banks. And ultimately, I suspect it's going to help them build pathways away. There's a great ad. I'm a big fan as a governance and management example of Starbucks. I think Starbucks is a remarkably well-managed company. And Howard Schultz, early on in the presidential campaign, gave a big speech about everybody better grow up and we need servant leadership. It was very charming. But he ran an ad yesterday in you can see it on Starbucks's website, and I've linked to it from the website. But he also ran it in a lot of the newspapers. It was in the Wall Street Journal. Let me just read it to you. When you read the headlines or turn on the news, when you scroll through your social media feed or listen to the candidates, you could easily mistake America as a nation lost, a people who have severed the common bonds that hold us together. Compassion, respect, shared responsibility, a belief in service, a willingness to unite despite our differences. Today, for just a moment, we wanted to pause and reflect, to go beyond the hatred and vitriol and see a different story of America. It's a story that is not bound by party affiliations or religious beliefs. It's not dependent on living in one zip code over another. It's not left-leaning or right-leaning. It's not about your income or your wealth. It lives in our small towns and also in our cities. In the classroom of a teacher who is fighting for the potential in every student, you see it in the volunteer who mentors youth and in those helping Americans' veterans successfully transition to civilian life, and in those who work to include rather than discriminate. You see it in the leader who invests in her community and in the nurse who treats the elderly with dignity. This is the story we believe in. This is not about the choice we make every 4 years. This is about the choices we make every single day. Anyway, one of the things you've heard again and again from me is that it is about the choices you make every single day. And the proof positive that Schultz is right is we see, and all this news is in food and health, just an outpouring of companies who are now being brought to their knees to label GMOs in their U.S. products. We have Cheerio makers General Mills saying they'll label GMOs in U.S. products. Vermont now has a labeling law, and I have a little article from Politico, How Vermont Beat Big Food. And now Mars and company, the parent company of M&M's and Snickers, and lots of other brands have followed General Mills. So what you can see is millions and millions of consumers and the choices they're making every day are insisting that these food companies do it, and the companies are literally having to cave into the consumer. So never underestimate the power of the choices we make every day to really make a difference, and it's really making a difference in food. Okay, there are enormous. I want to talk about inside baseball in the U.S. I'm going to talk through the campaign, but we're starting to see a window into all sorts of leadership differences, particularly as it relates to peace versus war. I put up a commentary today, and on the sort of inside baseball on the presidential campaign. What's very interesting is the candidates who are winning in the primaries are clearly from the polls, repeatedly not the candidates who win in the general election. Sanders does better than Clinton, is my read of the polls in the general election. And Kasich is the only one who can beat Sanders and Clinton. Trump clearly loses the general election. Cruz clearly loses the general election. So here we have Kasich, who's not able to win very many primaries at all, who's clearly the only one who can win the general election. That's putting the Republican Party in a very difficult situation because they really, if they're going to make sure they win the White House, they've got to have a brokered convention and they're going to have to swing it to Kasich or someone else who can clearly, that the polls indicate, can win the general election. The Republican leadership is obligated not just to put forward their best foot forward on the White House, but Congress and the state and local elections. And someone who's winning primaries but can't win the general election is going to get them clocked both on the congressional races and the state and local elections. So they're in a real conundrum here, and it's very interesting to read the polls. In my opinion, as I said, I failed completely to hold on my budget of only spending 10 hours watching the presidential race. But if you want to watch it, the most time effective way to do it is to track the polls and some of the primary coverage at Real Clear Politics by a former, I think he was a futures trader, but very mathematical in orientation. The second commentary is one we haven't put up yet, and I just want to talk you through it, but we'll get it up before sometime midweek next week. Donald Trump showed up at the Washington Post with his foreign advisory board. One of the members was a retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg. Kellogg had joined Oracle after leaving the military and then served with Paul Bremer in Iraq and then went to CACI. And for those of you who don't remember, that's the team that brought you Abu Ghraib and the torture pictures that were outed by 60 Minutes. Anyway, it's another example of the fact that I can't believe Trump would bring somebody deeply associated with Iraq and CACI. It's just kind of the mistakes that someone who hasn't had political experience makes. But it's exactly the kind of thing that could get him in enormous trouble in the general election. And what's interesting is, speaking of trouble in the general election, the FBI investigation into Clinton's sort of global racketeering with her email server and restricted information is likely to come to a head sometime between now and the summer or into midsummer. And there are really two possibilities. One is the FBI decides to indict her, and the other is either they don't recommend to indict her or the Department of Justice or the White House overturn their recommendation or don't accept their recommendation. And if that case, that's a clear message to the enforcement intelligence bureaucracies that not only does Clinton have immunity from national security laws, but it means a Clinton presidency, Clinton and her appointees are going to feel free to use confidential and national security information essentially to refresh their personal pockets. So it's a signal that in a Clinton administration, anything goes. And it's if you're responsible to deliver on covert operations, particularly after what happened at Benghazi, it puts you in extreme danger. And so one question, I put a video up on the website of a former assistant U.S. attorney basically saying that you're going to get the kind of pushback you got in Watergate. And if that pushback is loud enough, it could impact the election. I think there's another thing that can happen. If the pushback is somehow muffled and invisible, it could also accelerate implosion of the U.S. government. And in that case, the corporate, sort of the covert operations you depend on to keep the reserve currency going, and that could really impact what happens in the reserve currency and finances. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But no matter how any of these things play out, it looks to me like Trump and Clinton's negatives are just going to keep going higher. And I know I keep saying that Richmond Valentine is controlling 75% of the polling, but I think he's not controlling 100% yet. And if you don't understand what I mean by that, please read the commentary I wrote last week called The Kingsman Campaign, because it's an essential primer to help you understand what's really going on in the election. There, I also put a link to an Atlantic Monthly article that's getting a lot of comment throughout the political establishment and throughout both corporate media and internet media, and that is the Atlantic Monthly interview with Obama. And you're really seeing a split between sort of Kerry Obama and the old line WASPs who back them versus Clinton and the neocons who are very much, much more aggressive in their talk of, using force globally, and I'm almost wondering if this split wasn't what inspired Bill Clinton to trash Obama. He said in a speech recently, referred to the, quote, awful legacy of the last 8 years. And given that Obama ultimately is oversitting the decision as to whether his wife is indicted, you kind of wonder, you know, what in the world is Bill Clinton doing? It shows you the extent of the tension. I did an interview that we'll post next week with Don Cox, who very much is kind of taking the neocon approach about what's going on in Iran. And then the following week, you'll hear an interview from Saker, who takes a very different approach. And so what you're seeing is you're seeing a group that's very aggressive about continuing to insist on unipolar dominance, and another group that's saying it's a multipolar world, we have to adjust. So great tension in the leadership. Richard Mayberry, who is a newsletter writer who I have a lot of respect for, put out a report this week talking about the buildup in the South China Sea. As you remember, a couple weeks ago, I published a book review on two books about the South China Sea. I think what's going on in the South China Sea is unbelievably important. China's president had promised that he wasn't going to militarize the islands in the South China Sea, and then it came out in February from private satellite photos that the Chinese is in fact putting surface-to-air missiles on the Paracel Islands and are very much building up and militarizing the South China Sea. And given the importance of the South China Sea, you know, that's uncomfortable. Now, Mayberry's thesis is this is going on, you know, the Chinese are taking every opportunity to do this while Obama is still the president, knowing that whoever comes in subsequent is going to be much more difficult for the Chinese to deal with and much more aggressive. And the sort of Mayberry's take is buy defense stocks, you know, there's going to be war. So it will be very interesting because Clinton was the one who was very aggressive in terms of supporting and talking about the pivot to Asia. But there's no doubt that there is a very sensitive situation in the South China Sea and incredibly important to the status of the dollar as reserve currency, in my opinion. Anyway, so lots of tension within the U.S. leadership, and you're going to see that come out in the campaign. Particularly as the people who are financially dependent on war promote more and more war. And that's why it's very interesting that Trump shows up with a group of people who are basically defense contractors. Okay, a couple other things I wanted to point out on the website. I did a review of The Devil's Chessboard, which is David Talbot's new book on Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. It's an extraordinary book, and I've just talked to David, and he's agreed to join me on the Saleri Report in April. So take a look at the review. Because David wanted to put it on his Facebook page, we took it public. So it's right there on the front of the homepage. It's a remarkable book. If you want to understand the Kennedy assassination, it makes an extraordinary, one of the best contributions to understanding the Kennedy assassination that I've seen to date. Finally, one other thing on the website. I wrote, various subscribers keep asking me for sort of instructions on how to do place-based financial statements and how they can encourage their representatives to sort of make all that disclosure accessible. So I wrote a letter to my congressman, Marsha Blackburn, and put it up on the website. I would encourage everyone, you know, get to your, if you're at a town hall meeting with your congressman, or you know your congressman, if you know your congressman's staff, definitely write to them, send that letter, and don't believe them when they tell you, well, we can't put that up because the terrorists will get it. You know, every company that you own stock in can mail you an annual report. So if it's not safe to put it on the web, they can put it in an annual report and mail it to you. But anyway, the more people who send that into Congress, the better. But finally, I wanted to, in the spirit of never late, too late to explain how things work, a journalist who interviewed John Ehrlichman long ago finally disgorged some of his most interesting quotes. Let me read one of them to you. Ehrlichman, of course, assistant to Nixon, and ended up in prison as a result of what happened at Watergate. So this is John Ehrlichman speaking. Quote, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. Anyway, well, that's a important comment on the war on drugs, but you need to, in your mind, shift it to the war on terror, because the war on terror is being used in the same exact way. Our hero this week is Helen Chapman, a New York attorney, a litigator, who's just published a remarkable book, J.P. Madoff, about the relationship between J.P. Morgan and Madoff, and how Madoff could never have happened without J.P. Morgan Chase. It's called, the subtitle is The Unholy Alliance Between America's Biggest Bank and America's Biggest Crook. Chapman lost her life savings in Madoff, but she was still working as an attorney, and has represented hundreds of the Madoff victims. And I originally came to know of her work because of working with a number of people who had had money and assets in Madoff. So anyway, she has now agreed she's going to come on the Salieri Report too. And so I'm hoping you'll hear that in April and May. J.P. Madoff. It's a remarkable effort, a remarkable book. On her website, or on a law firm's website, she has a great quote from Aristotle, which I absolutely believe. At his best, man is the noblest of all animals. Separated from law and justice, he is the worst. And boy, can't you relate to that, given what's going on in the world. Ask Catherine. We have a lot of questions. You sent us some great links, including the link about Pizza Hut now delivering with robots. So it's coming, it's coming. Keep sending us those. We're really getting some remarkable things from subscribers. Someone sent a video report that HUD is essentially outlawing people's ability to live full-time in RVs and tiny homes. Those are proposed regulations. They haven't gone final. And they asked the question, why is our government focusing on the weeds rather than the major problem of the economic bubble? How do they benefit? It's very simple. You make money in the weeds. If you outlaw people living in RVs and tiny homes, you're basically taking many millions of people and saying, okay, you've got to go live in a home. You can't live where you're living now. That's going to be great for the manufactured housing industry. The number one maker of manufacturing housing, as well as financing it, is Warren Buffett company. Many years ago, he bought Clayton Homes. So companies like Buffett's are going to benefit enormously. They're going to get more sales. They're going to get more. They're going to get more financing fees. That turns into more profits for them. There's a great example in my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, about the relationship between how you change government laws, regulations, contracts in a way that makes stock goes up, the private guys make money, and that is the basis whereby they can turn around and give you political contributions. So it's a, call it a non-virtuous cycle. But government makes a great deal of money for private companies by fiddling with the weeds and the rules. And basically our economy, the economy for small anything in this country has been absolutely devastated by these rules. If you look at Tennessee, where I live, most of the small farmers have been put out of business, not by the market, not by, the ability of large guys to do it better. We've been put out of business by the safety rules that make it impossible for local farmers to basically sell to their neighbors. Joel Salen, who's arguably the most successful, financially successful small farmer in America, has a great book called Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. So he does a great job of explaining how the regulations have basically been designed to aggregate all the food, the food sales into the big companies. Somebody asks, what is your best advice to one of your subscribers running for Congress next cycle? I need to know a lot more specifics about where they're running and their background, et cetera. So without an individual fact pattern, it's very hard to generalize. One thing I would recommend very strongly is they listen to or read the transcripts for our interviews in the last 2 years with Wilkerson, Congressman Kaptur, and Congressman former Congressman McKinney, as well as Bob Lytan, who worked at OMB and has held a lot of different positions in Washington or Washington policy shops, than Stephen Roche. And I would also read the complete Farrell, Dolan, and Trombley interviews. I think those would all be enormously helpful. Then the same person asked also, have you considered an interview with Kay Griggs? Kay Griggs is was an officer's wife who, after her divorce, was interviewed and told a great deal about the bizarre culture of the American military and intelligence complex. And I posted her interviews on the website. They're very long and detailed. So I didn't plan on inviting her, as I don't think there's much to add. I think the interviews that have been made available are very complete. And so if you're interested, just do a search for Kay Griggs, and you will learn more about the sort of bizarre culture in the military and intelligence complex. I think my sense is she's probably a credible witness. Dear Catherine, for people who are geographically too far to attend your Lunch with Catherine events, have you thought about streaming one or more of them on the internet or recording them so your members can watch them? The answer is absolutely not. These luncheons are private and they're an intimate setting, and that's so people can be free to speak their mind and are free to meet each other, which is very important. It's a way of helping subscribers in place get connected, and people need to feel safe and not recorded and not watched at all. So no, these are power lunches, so they're very private and they're very intimate. And I think it's one of the reasons. I know the lunch at 21 was absolutely extraordinary. Experience. I drove up from Philadelphia with a colleague who's an asset manager I work with, and we drove back, and I said, I haven't had that much fun since 1995. And 1995 was right before the, sort of my 11-year enemy of the state period started. And I'm sure it would never have been as richly rewarding as it was if we had been recording it. Dear Catherine, do you think the powers that be are concerned about Donald Trump becoming president, or do you think that they own him and feel confident that he'll follow through with their own agenda if he gets elected? If you want to understand what I think about that, read the commentary, The Kingsman Campaign. So it depends on who you refer to as the powers that be. But certainly you have at least one very dominant faction, if not Mr. Global, who wants Trump to do what he's doing now. I think he's whiting out the Republicans for Clinton. So he's really being engineered by a deep state that wants Clinton to be president, and that's the side of the House that really wants much more aggression and warlike behavior to continue the unipolar dominance of the United States. Hi, Catherine. I really appreciated your lengthy interview with Joseph Farrell. It's hard not to be affected by the continuing imminent collapse meme. I have been hearing it since the 70s. Mostly, I've come to realize that what is happening is a slow train wreck. So many are currently saying that we're going to have economic collapse this year, that it can't possibly be true. You're funny. However, in weak moments, I can become anxious. This interview helped relieve that anxiety until, in the summary, Joseph stated that if we don't change things, we're facing a collapse of the government, economy, and society. This after having said that we probably won't realize that change in our lifetimes. So I was left with the anxiety creeping back in. Can you clarify this seemingly conflicting message? When I get Joseph back on, I'll ask him about that, because I didn't realize that there was that time difference. Essentially, what you've got is you've got 2.0 collapsing and you've got 3.0 rising. And And there are many possible scenarios. One of my questions is, how much do the 3.0 guys care that the 2.0 collapse is a steady, slow burn as opposed to an accelerating collapse? That's number one. But the other is, if we have, people like a Clinton or a Trump who are literally in important positions, you could see enormous pushback from the bureaucracies of the kind that I just talked about. So there absolutely are scenarios where things can get very rocky. And also, of course, I think the global economy is really slowing down, and we're going to see a lot of pain globally, and both in China, we're going to see pain in Europe, pain here. And of course, there are arguments why America is the strongest one of all of them. And I think that will argue for not having an acceleration of the collapse. But anything is possible here. Jeremy Grantham, who is a asset manager I have a lot of respect for, in his quarterly newsletter did a piece on American exceptionalism, which I thought was good. And he talked about our strength in entrepreneurship and our strength in venture capital, and then our strength in being self-sufficient in oil and gas and food. And in fact, BP has just come out with a new report saying we'll be completely energy self-sufficient within 5 years, which I think is a reasonable estimate. It's a very interesting report because it shows the contribution of both renewables and gas and the growth. I've been very concerned about the drop-off in entrepreneurship and the harming of that aspect of the economy through the centralization of control, and that's why I had Bob Lytan on to talk about that. I think Grantham doesn't have the understanding of the extent to which it's dropped that Lytan does. That's really Lytan's extraordinary expertise. But Grantham is just comparing us to other countries around the world, and in that sense, he's correct with respect to many other things. The big question is one I talk about in the Don Cox interview, which is after the election, we're going to have to face and deal with both serious pension fund problems and budget woes that have been really pushed under the rug by all the whiteout. And when those come to fruition, the U.S. middle class is in for real hard times. Now, there are many things we can do to turn the ship and deal with that effectively. We're not doing any of them. We're doing some of the 3.0 is doing a lot of the technology, but I have no indications that they feel obligated to turn around and use the assets that have been shifted out of 2.0 to help 2.0 and the retirement assets. So you have to do a scenario design to posit the different ways it could go. I think the chances of a collapse are very, very small. But the reality is, with 3.0 rising, the system doesn't collapse. But if you're in 2.0 and either the place or the sector of the economy that you're in is collapsing, you are in a collapse. So you have to think of it in a much more granular way. And I would really want to stress one thing: collapse is what you is not the scenario you need to be most afraid of. If you want to get anxiety creeping back in, let it creep in about, a continual slow burn. Because a continual slow burn with more and more centralization going into the kind of things that we probably need to talk more about here, which is transhumanism, is infinitely worse than, in my opinion, than collapse. Okay, next question. I'm wondering if, apart from silver and gold, it would be possible to get to Catherine the suggestion request that Rambis try and address the commodities markets, and then he had some specifics. I'll suggest that to Rambis and see what he says. Hi, Catherine and Solari team. I've been trying to understand the inflation-deflation debate, and it seems as though the consensus is definitely on the inflation side. The only question seems to be whether or not we will see some sort of significant deflationary cycle before returning to inflation. Thoughts? After the dips in the markets last August and more recently, I have to ask, who's buying this market? Finally, I know you can't provide individual investment advice, but could you please comment on holding onto cash until after the election cycle? As I'm Canadian, I will be holding Canadian dollars. However, I'm interested in hearing what you think of holding on to cash in general. Thanks for everything you do. I look forward to hearing from you. Just one note, we will be, the first quarter wrap up will be on where you stash your cash in 2016. So I'll talk about that a little bit more. I definitely believe in holding on to cash as part of a balanced approach. Of course, the problem is opportunity costs. If you keep your money in relatively short duration fixed income or hedged equity, you're going to get anywhere from 0.5% to 3% at least. If the equity markets are better, you'll get more. So I prefer to keep money engaged as opposed to have an automatic loss, which I think you're going to have in cash because the whatever currency you're holding, it's going to be debased. So although as commodities come back, if you're holding in Canadian dollars, the outlook, if anything, Canadian should be down right now. But I absolutely believe in balance, and there's nothing like having liquidity. One of the things that most contributes to a successful growth of your net worth is having liquidity when it's good to have liquidity. And I suspect that sometime after the election will come a time when it will be very nice to have liquidity. So I absolutely believe in having a core position in cash. Dear Catherine, you often speak of the importance of detoxing. You've made it clear you practice what you preach. I'm wondering what methods you use. There are many options. I did a Solari report with Laura Thompson in January 2013 on detoxification. It's all just as relevant today as it was then. And there's an entire list of 14 things. I'll read them to you, all of which I have done or do. So let me read them. Testing. It's very important to test and see where you are on all these things. Nutrition, hydration, juicing, and fasting was item 3. Prayer, meditation, de-stress, 4. Breathing, unbelievably important. The 6 was oral and intravenous chelation. I have not done intravenous chelation. I've only done oral chelation. I find it unbelievably effective, but it can be very difficult to do it and work and stay clear at the same time. Number 7 was lymph therapy, skin brushing. Number 8 was colon cleansing, hydrotherapy, and coffee enemas. Number 9 was infrared saunas. Number 10, iron cleanse and foot baths. Number 11 was detox foot pads. Number 12 was liver, gall, bladder, and kidney flushes. Number 13 was castor oil packs. Number 14 was clay packs, both full body and thyroid packs. I've used all of them and been very pleased with all of them, except for, as I said, intravenous chelation. What I believe is everybody is different, and you've just got to try these things and figure out what works for you. One thing to do is to get with someone like Laura Thompson, Dr. Thompson, and do an individual consultation and develop a program and then just go through and try these things. The other thing is the new series by Ty Bollinger, The Truth About Cancer, goes into a lot of different detox methods as well as the importance of detox. And I think it does a very good job of not only explaining all of that, but inspiring you to understand the importance and try things. And then he says, I love the last show with the Memphian Safe Master, never a dull moment with that guy. Our Let's Go to the Movies is this year, this year's Academy Award winner, Spotlight. It's about the Boston Globe Spotlight team, which is the oldest continuous operating newspaper investigative journalist unit in the United States. And it had a Pulitzer Prize winning story on child sex abuse in the Boston area by the Catholic Church. It's a very, in the world of journalism, a very famous story. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it is our interview with Dr. Hamamoto touches on the pedophilia networks and the sort of compromising of leadership with pedophilia. So it touches on our big interview today. I will say this, if you look at the child sex abuse scandals of the Catholic Church, in my opinion, we've never heard the full story. The full story is far worse, and it doesn't just involve the Catholic Church. It involves the Masons. It involves the intelligence agencies. It's a much more systemic story than just horny priests. That's, to me, that's a cover story, not to say that doesn't happen. The reason I wanted to recommend Spotlight is it has several tremendous strengths. One is it shows the breadth of the complicity in the pedophilia networks. You see just how many people kept their mouth shut as this was happening. In it, there's an attorney based on a real attorney who represents the families and the children who were abused. It's an Armenian guy who's really clearly a remarkable attorney. And one of the things he says, he blows up at one point, he says, if it takes a village to raise a child, it takes a village to abuse a child. And I think it's one of the most profound statements I've ever heard about the pedophilia networks and the extent of the complicity, which is enormous and which none of us want to face. We want to say, oh, they are the bad guys, and we don't want to face the extraordinary complicity that goes along. The other thing is, there's a great little scene that I related to very personally where the lawyer explains how all the documents he's filed that are supposed to be public are missing. And the investigative journalist who's interviewing can't believe that the church has the power to have the courts just make documents go missing. Well, that's something I experienced many times when I litigated with the federal government. And I just had to chuckle because, having dealt with it on a number of occasions and seen the power of the power of documents to disappear and how that would affect disclosure in the case, I don't know, I just had to chuckle. So it really helps you understand the extent to which the system has and can be manipulated by powerful institutions. Okay, our interview this week is with Dr. Daryl Hamamoto, remarkable professor from UC Davis in the University of California system. I first wanted to interview Dr. Hamamoto because he gave a great interview to Alex Jones that we had up on the website about the extent to which kids were being manipulated by the entrainment technology, and that was why you're seeing some of the more bizarre behavior in the universities, and how difficult it is to teach in this environment when you're competing with kids who are literally on smartphones and acting like zombies. And he's been very outspoken. This guy's really fearless. Our quote for the commentary was from Oscar Wilde: "If you want to tell people the truth, make them laugh. Otherwise, they'll kill you." He's a very intelligent, charming man, so he does a pretty good job of making people laugh. He wanted to talk about the financial models, or the economic models operating at the universities, and how it relates to the larger financial models in America. And you have to forgive me when you listen to the interview, because I have so many thoughts on that and sort of the public model and the private model, and to get in and see it. So I talked a lot more than I usually like to talk, and certainly he's a fascinating guy, so forgive me if I talk too much. But we really did do a pretty good job of laying out sort of the model issues, and I hope it really helps you see those models, because I think if you're gonna be in and around universities, if you're gonna have relatives or yourself who are attending universities, teaching at universities, it's absolutely essential to understand the model. If you go into a university and you think you're at a university and the goal is academic freedom and knowledge and teaching, and that's it, you could get yourself in a whole lot of trouble. So it's if you're going to navigate the university environment, you really have to understand and see how the model works. So I hope that helps. I think for somebody who is in and around a university, understanding that model could be invaluable. And if it's not clear from the interview, please send some questions to Ask Catherine. Okay, in closing, we have two great interviews coming up, one with Don Cox, one of my favorite investment advisors. Next week, we'll be talking about what's next, commodities and negative interest rates. And then the following week, a great interview with Asaker Back. He's now going to do quarterly interviews with us, called The Emerging Multipolar World. And to a certain extent, Don and the Asaker take opposite opinions on things like the Iran deal. So Saker is somebody who's more interested in moving to a multipolar world. Don is more interested in sort of the unipolar world, but both great guys, and you see both sides of the argument. Then on April 14th, we have the first quarter wrap-up. And our equity overview, we're going to do them as a double header. And the theme this for the first quarter wrap-up is, where do I stash my cash in 2016? And then we're shooting our target launch date for the new website is April 18th. And again, I think you'll be very, very pleased with that. So ladies and gentlemen, until March 31st with Don Cox, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.